Welcome to the Milk and Motherhood podcast, where we're having an ongoing conversation about breastfeeding, postpartum, parenthood, the challenges these can present, and the hope we have for overcoming them. I'm your host, Therese Dansby. I'm a registered nurse, international board certified lactation consultant, and homeschooling mom of three. I believe that navigating the rough waters of early motherhood with wisdom, grace, and humility can grow each of us into the mothers we long to be. Hey guys, it's not a comeback, but I am excited to be back on the podcast today with my friend Stephanie Reisinger. She's been here before. She is a mental health therapist. She works with moms before, during, and after pregnancy. And she and I love having these conversations about things like birth control and women's health and women's health care or lack thereof. And so when this article came out from the Washington Post a few days ago called Women Are Getting Off Birth Control Amid Misinformation Explosion, I knew I needed to talk to Stephanie about it because she's my go-to person for these kind of conversations. And I thought, why not record it? Why not have a civil conversation, bringing critical thinking into this? You know, we are not rallying for one side or the other per se. We're just discussing this article with an eye on common sense. And I think that's going to be needed more and more over the next few months as women's issues, quote unquote, become fodder for political conversation on all sides of the spectrum. All right. Well, hello. I am here today with my friend Stephanie Reisinger, and she and I have been having a conversation about birth control on and off for years, just as friends and as professionals who work with women. And I think just last week we were talking about the O pill and the news about this birth control pill coming out over the counter. And then 4 days ago, this article came out on the Washington Post. And I thought we're going to talk about this anyways. So why not record it and have this conversation with a couple hundred of our friends? So welcome, Stephanie.
Thanks, Therese. I'm happy to be here. And this is so perfect because you're absolutely right. Like, this is the exact kind of conversation we would be having anyway over Voxer. So we might as well just let some other people in on it since.
Yes, because it's so nuanced. And I feel like it's hard to find voices who are willing to critically think about these things on either side of the spectrum. So I always appreciate that with you. And you're my first repeat guest.
Hey.
Stephanie was on my podcast on episode 5. It was called When You Don't Feel Like Yourself Postpartum, and it was about postpartum mood disorders. So do you want to just introduce yourself now? Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I'm a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist specializing in perinatal mental health. And so I work with women and families who are experiencing difficulty during pregnancy, postpartum, infertility, loss, and all those things that are connected. And I also recently have started educating other allied providers on perinatal mental health basics, and I'm writing a book about miscarriage. So those are the things I do.
Yeah, these are the things that we love to talk about because, again, it's just, they're so nuanced and they cut so deeply to the core of what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a mother, and just how we navigate this healthcare system that we live in the US as providers and as women who have had various issues with female things. If you want to share whatever you're comfortable sharing, just kind of your own personal maybe history with birth control, thoughts on it, how things have changed.
Yeah. Well, personally, I was put on birth control, I believe, for acne. And so I'd had acne for a very long time. I had taken, why can't I think of what it's called now? That horrible medication.
Oh, Accutane.
Accutane, yes.
I didn't know that. I took that too.
Did you? Oh.
Yeah.
Terrible. But I did take Accutane. It's 2 rounds of Accutane, which is a whole other thing that I could talk about as far as, honestly, about reproductive health and Accutane. But I had taken that and still had some issues with acne. And so my provider decided to prescribe me hormonal birth control. As a 21 year old, I had no idea or reason to think that this would not be a good idea. And so I remained on the birth control pill, ortho tricycline, until I was 25. And so for about 4 years, and that's when my husband and I started trying to get pregnant. So I just came off of it in order to do that. I personally didn't notice any specific side effects. That doesn't mean there weren't any, but I didn't have any specific complaints in relation to being on it. But, you know, if I could go back, I would have never taken it, knowing what I know now.
Have you changed kind of even how you felt philosophically about it? Or when did that kind of start to turn?
Yeah, I don't think that started to turn until, I don't know, gosh, probably a few years into trying to conceive. You know, as I started to learn about the menstrual cycle and about fertility, that led into having a deeper understanding of hormonal birth control. And then I started to philosophically have some issues with it and concerns with it, just as far as the potential side effects, the ways in which it disconnects women from their own experience, the experience that happens naturally within our bodies of having a menstrual cycle and all of the actual benefits of that, on top of the what we'll talk about, I'm sure, the medical gaslighting that happens as a result of birth control being available and something that can suppress symptoms rather than allow medical providers to actually treat whatever's going on with their patient. So I have all kinds of issues with it now.
Yes. And I think maybe you and I have different experiences. I'll share mine in a second of, this article that we're going to talk about gets into maybe, people claim that the pill causes infertility, whereas perhaps you and I would say, like you just said, it masks your cycle and you're not aware of potential fertility issues even, and then you go off the pill and you just expect to start cycling. And my experience in coming at it with endometriosis is it masking symptoms for a long time and avoiding diagnosis of something that I wish that I had dealt with 15 years ago, but didn't even get diagnosed with until, now. So I went on the pill. My parents put me on the pill when I was 16, and they thought they were doing what was best because I had an eating disorder and I lost my cycle. And so they knew that's not healthy. So, what they didn't know is that the pill is not restarting your cycle, but that's a little bit besides the point. And then I got into a vicious cycle of even my early periods were very painful and heavy. So being on the pill was a relief from that. And then every time I tried to get off of it, my cycles would be horrible and my acne would be horrible. And so then I'd get back on it. And that was a 10-year process. And I actually, if miscarriage is a trigger warning, like skip ahead for 2 minutes. But I was so uninformed about my cycle, even having gone through nursing school, gone through maternity, gone through the grad school classes. I have all but my clinical hours for nurse practitioner school. And it, I still did not understand my cycle enough to know that, like, even being off the pill for 2 weeks, you could get pregnant. So we moved, and I was off the pill for 2 weeks, and I got pregnant, and I didn't know it. And I got back on the pill, and then I miscarried at 8 weeks. And yeah, and that was the last straw for me. Like, well, they say that, the pill doesn't cause pregnancy loss, it just prevents ovulation, et cetera, et cetera. My experience kind of quickly caused me to ask questions about that, but that was after 10 years on the pill, So, and then, like you, after I came off of it, I started to ask some more questions about it. But I was kind of this empowered mindset. Like, I'm going to be in charge of my cycle. My cycle is not in charge of me. And as somebody who had a ton of symptoms, which now I know were related to a much bigger issue, it is a very dismissive way of doctors practicing because they want to help, right? Most of our doctors want to help, but if they haven't gotten extra training and extra education on the cycle, then the pill looks like a good, it makes things look good on paper. So There we are.
Yes, my patient
Yeah.
feels better now. And
Yeah.
so problem solved.
Yeah, their cycles are normal. They're, whatever. Their bleeding is lighter. I even had a midwife who I absolutely love, but when I was pregnant with my second, I said, "Hey, what do you know about progesterone, postpartum mood disorders, et cetera, et cetera?" She was like, "Well, if you're concerned about progesterone, I'll just put you on the mini pill at 6 weeks postpartum." And I was like, "That's not progesterone, that's progestin." And so, yeah, let's just so we're going to talk about this Washington Post article. It's called "Women Are Getting Off of Birth Control Amid a Misinformation Explosion," and it came out 4 days ago. And at first I didn't read it because I thought it sounded like clickbait, which after reading it kind of is.
Yeah.
But there has been so much shared on social media. I actually saw a post by someone that said, "Do you want to know what medical gaslighting and negligence looks like on a mass level?" And then it started sharing quotes from this article, and I was like, "Now I have to read it." And that basically summarizes how I feel about it. But let's define some terms really quickly. Since you are the mental health care professional, do you want to define gaslighting? I think most people have a concept of it by now, but
Yeah, gaslighting is essentially convincing another person that they're crazy. So it's when one party expresses concern about something and the other party turns it back on that first party and says, no, this is actually, you're actually the problem, or this is all in your head. And so it causes that person to really question themselves and be unsure about what they're actual lived experiences.
Yeah, and that is definitely a criticism within this article is criticizing women's lived experiences, which is unfortunate because it's written by two women.
Ugh, yes. Yes.
And the term misinformation, I feel like has lost all meaning at this point because anyone can say anything is misinformation because it doesn't align with how they feel about it. Same with the word science. I feel like, a true practicing scientist is not going to say the science is settled ever.
Ever. I
That's
was just thinking
not.
about this yesterday about this article. Yes. That's one of the things that was in there was like, as physicians believe this is safe or say this is safe or whatever that phrase was, they're essentially saying, okay, this is all settled already. And the medical community all agrees upon this being settled. And so, no new information could possibly come in that would change our minds. And that is completely unscientific.
Yes, it is. It is wild. The big picture here, I think, on all sides of this discussion is the issue of informed consent and the issue of where is the autonomy in your healthcare? And this article is arguing that it should lie with your doctor and not with social media. And I think you and I are coming at it from, well, I'm responsible for my healthcare. And that argument doesn't really even enter into this article at all.
Right, for sure. Yeah, women don't get to have a say essentially in what is best for them. That's a lot of what I was understanding from this article.
Yeah. And I think, you learn in Research 101 in college that there are qualitative studies. And there are quantitative studies. And this article, now I haven't combed through it with a fine-tooth comb, but there aren't any studies mentioned in this article at all. There are just quotes, which is a red flag for somebody who worked in my college newspaper for 4 years. This was in the early aughts before social media and before clickbait existed. But
Right.
journalism has always been a controversial field of where do free speech and misinformation collide? I'm okay with free speech, except, but all these people sharing their lived experience of birth control, well, that's misinformation, not free speech. And that kind of gets entered into this article as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, essentially, where we get so many people yelling or screaming misinformation is about people simply sharing what they are, they're sharing their own experiences. And when others are so concerned about people sharing their own experiences, it's as if they're saying the general population is so dumb that they can't take in information and decide whether or not this is valuable information or whether or not they can or should do something with it. And I do believe that we're losing a bit of critical thinking skills as a society as a whole. But at the same time, the answer is not to then silence all information. It's to teach people how to think critically about the information that they are consuming.
Yeah, I was gonna mention critical thinking too. And I'm guilty of it too, right? We've all bought into things that sounded good, or they answered a question that we couldn't have get answered anywhere else. We've all done that. And there's always going to be a spectrum of learning something new and implementing it and deciding if it's right for you to a certain degree. And I do think that this article and probably the media at large have, yes, lost that respect for their readers. And I think we'll get into this more, but I think it comes back to needing to ask questions of everyone, of your doctor, of influencers on social media. You have to take it a step further. Does that make sense? How does this look on the ground? Where is this information coming from? I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there is also, is there an agenda here? I do think it's interesting that this article came out like a week after the birth control pill became available over the counter.
Ooh, that is quite interesting. I didn't even think about that connection.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that these people have any sort of financial stake whatsoever in the O pill, but it's interesting timing because there's been some backlash in some states with that pill not requiring any sort of doctor's permission at all. And we were just talking last week, like, that doesn't seem responsible. That's not informed consent at all. This is a real medication with real risks and side effects, and it doesn't even have an age limitation on it. So, yeah, where do you want to go next? Do you want to get into that? Do you want to talk about cycle tracking and social media versus actual natural family planning? Where do you want to go next?
Yeah, we can do that. We can do that
Okay.
one.
So, this is something that you and I have had a lot of interest in as we learn more about our own health, is different forms of natural family planning. And I think that this article does fail to distinguish between them all. There are apps or rhythm methods or things like that that are not going to effectively prevent pregnancy for a lot of people, but that's very different. Lumping those in with all natural family planning methods is not very responsible because there are a lot of evidence-backed ones that are actually more effective than the birth control pill with perfect use. Let's talk about cycles.
Let's please do that. And I think the big, that big misconception is that it's incredibly risky, basically, to use a natural family planning method rather than hormonal birth control, which is not risky. Like that's the idea. And there was a bit of fear mongering in this article as well around that this is a less effective birth control method that can lead to unplanned pregnancy. And then even going into as more and more states have banned abortion, and it's just like, oh my goodness, like that elevated quickly. And so yeah, we went very quickly from social media influencers are recommending timing sex with your menstrual cycle, and then all the way to you're going to get pregnant and not be able to have an abortion. Like it's whoa. Whoa. But yeah, there are so many helpful, educated, well-researched tools and educators at this point that it is actually so much easier today, I think, to practice natural family planning methods than it has been for at least for as long as I can remember. And for me, it was just I found Tony Weschler's book at a garage sale when I was like 26, Taking
The
Charge of Your
taken, yeah.
Fertility. Yeah, that, teaches you how to chart your menstrual cycle. And that was wonderful. That was super helpful. And now there's so much more. Like, Lisa Hendrickson-Jack doing her well-researched book, The Fifth Vital Sign, and her podcast Fertility Friday. Like, this woman is so well educated on this stuff. And Jolene Brighton. I mean, there are so many smart people who know what they're doing, who can provide information that can be and very effective. And so many women have found so much benefit from being able to practice in this way.
And I think having come from a Catholic background, there are a lot of very heavily researched methods that go by different names, right? They're all kind of modifications of the same. There are only so many ways to track your fertility. But, if somebody wanted to look into the research of the Marquette method, I mean, this is not an influencer telling you about your cycle. This is and the Creighton method, Billings method, and then the symptothermal method is very similar to what taking charge of your fertility teaches. And so I think it's a matter of asking, your provider, and by provider I mean a fertility practitioner, not your doctor. You should ask this question of your doctor too. What additional training have you taken to learn about these things, and what kind of experience do you have with them? Because I'll tell you, in nursing school, like I said, a day, it was a question on a test, like, what is the follicular phase and what is the luteal phase? Like, and they still didn't even click in my head until I really started, like, ditched the pill and started diving into it more.
I love that you said that these are questions you should ask your medical provider. What information do you have about this? What education do you have about this to see whether or not an opinion that you want to use, or if you want to find a different opinion. And I remember being specifically told when I did actually get pregnant while using a natural family planning method and not using it effectively. Like, yes, that does happen.
Yes,
That
it
does
does.
happen because I did
Yeah.
not use it effectively. This was a user error, okay?
Yeah.
And I remember my doctor basically saying, like, yeah, that's pretty much how it goes. Like, rather than there being an understanding that, sometimes this can happen, or basically it was discredited or dismissed as a viable option. Sort of like, well, shouldn't have done that.
So the numbers are very similar, specifically when you look at Billings and Creighton method and the pill. Very similar in terms of perfect use and imperfect use and the efficacy. So, I think the article does miss the boat on that because that's lumping all of those things together. And I think when you have only ever relied on birth control and never learned about your own body, that is going to be your paradigm, because that was my paradigm, absolutely, as a person and as a healthcare provider. Like, why would you even bother learning that if this can, if I can take an extra week of pills and prolong my period so I can go on that beach vacation or like run that marathon? I mean, why wouldn't you want to be in control of that, right? I mean, it's a whole different way of thinking about things.
Oh, it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that idea
And
of like controlling your body versus understanding your body and supporting it well.
yeah, and just respecting it, because that's how life is. Like, it's not a perfect set of variables that you can manipulate. And I think that that's kind of what we tried to turn fertility into, both in terms of preventing pregnancy and abortion rights and infertility issues. It really turns everything on its head when we think we could control it and then we can't. And I do just want to throw in there that I think both of us would consider ourselves pro-life, but the pill has always for me been like, but some women are not in control of their bodies, which is a very sad reality. Do I think the pill should be banned 100%? Probably not. There are also medical reasons. I know in the endometriosis world, like, where we need to just suppress your cycles or stop prolonged bleeding or do something until we can get to the OR or until we've resolved this problem, or so we're not like abandoning critical thinking here. We are
Not saying
acknowledging that there's a
there's
time and
no,
place.
yeah, for sure. That we not to say that there is no use for it ever at any time, or it should totally be stopped being used, but informed consent, always informed consent. And the big problem is that the vast majority of women and girls are never informed truly about the risks of using hormonal birth control.
100%. And I think now with it becoming over the counter, so Yasmin is what I took. Yaz is the progestin only version, and then Yasmin is the combo pill with progesterone and estrogen and or derivatives thereof. And so I went to their website today, and first of all, again, not a conspiracy theorist, but when you click on the patient information tab, the page is unavailable. I don't know why. On both Yaz and Yasmin. So I went to the provider information because I can read those words and understand what they mean. And honestly, everybody can. So I don't know why there are two different tabs, but
Yeah, it is also interesting.
yeah. But on Yaz and Yasmin, it says a complete medical history and physical examination should be taken prior to the initiation or reinstitution of Yaz or Yasmin, same disclaimer, guided by the contraindications and warnings, and should be repeated periodically. So right now, this is the standard recommendation for the pill, but now it's being sold over the counter, and that this wasn't happening before, and it's definitely not going to happen when you can pick it up at the pharmacy. So that's concerning.
So concerning. Yeah.
Some of this article, really, the gaslighting portion of it is the authors saying that these lived experiences are not real, and kind of quoting doctors that are saying that these side effects are minimal or they're not real. And so that's why I went to the page from Bayer, the maker of these medications, or at least the two that I looked at. And most of the things that the quote unquote influencers were saying were in the common side effects category, like right there on the website by the manufacturer. Which is just wild. It's irresponsible journalism, and it's really not any better than a social media influencer saying this. If the influencer doesn't have authority, why does the journalist have authority?
Oh, right. Oh, my goodness. That is also an excellent point.
Yeah. I mean, and so I'll read some of these and chime in wherever you want to. First of all, I didn't even know honestly how many women of childbearing age there were in the US at this point in time. There are a lot, like 72.2 million women of childbearing age in the US right now. So there's kind of two different sets of statistics. One is that at any point in time during their childbearing years, this was in 2000, the USPharmacist.com survey, 99% of sexually active women of childbearing age have used some form of contraception at some point in their life, which is a huge number, but we're talking surgical methods, the pill, IUD. Do they still do the implanted rod things, the ring, condoms? Is that talking about every method ever? I was surprised to hear 99% though.
Yeah, that is surprising.
That, but like, have ever used. And so I'm like, okay, have ever used any form of contraception? I don't know if natural family planning was listed there. Some Orthodox religions consider natural family planning a form of birth control. I don't know if the research considers it a form of birth control. I'm inclined to say no, but I don't know.
That would be important probably to
Yeah.
note.
Yeah. And then the CDC.gov. So the reason I looked at these numbers is because the common side effects are one in 100 women. So I was like, how many women does that make? And I'm not going to do the math in my head, but if there are 72 million women, and then the CDC.gov, their last national survey of family growth was 2015 to 2017, and it said that at any given time, about 65% of women of childbearing age are using some form of contraception. So that was not ever used. That was like right now, 65 women, percent of women are somehow actively trying to avoid pregnancy. which was honestly lower than I
Yeah,
expected.
I think that's lower than I would expect.
So, and I guess that's all women, not just sexually active women and et cetera, et cetera. A lot of different. So again, it's like numbers, you can't just quote them. There's a lot behind numbers.
Definitely
The
to be
interesting
true.
thing about this is that it broke it down. So it said female sterilization, which terrible term, tubal ligation, 18.6%. Oral contraceptives, which is the pill, which is mostly what this article is talking about, only 12.6%, which that surprised me. Then long acting, but reversible. So we're talking about the implants and the IUDs, 10.3%, which again, when I think about like my friend group, I'm like, I don't know, those numbers feel very low. So then
Yeah, especially
male
if
condoms, 8.7. Yeah. And this
tubal
was on the
ligation being
CDC.
higher.
I
That's
would think they would be higher
yeah, that's really surprising to me.
than male condom use, 8.7%. And then things like diaphragms and things like sponges and spermicides were pretty low. Vasectomy was not on there at all, which I thought was interesting. I know, so I'm just like the numbers are so, you just have so many questions right off the bat. So assuming that, oh my gosh, I can't do this math. What, 72 million women are a childbearing age and 10% of them are on the pill. I mean, still, what do you have?
Million. Is that 7 million? Yeah.
Now we're saying 1% of those are still going to have a common side effect, which is a lot of women.
There's a lot of
Okay.
women.
So this article is dismissive of that without ever
Yeah.
sharing any of those numbers. So the
Yes,
article.
that's 700,000, I believe. I think I'm doing the math right here.
Okay. That's a lot of women. Yeah.
700,000 women. That's a huge number of women.
Yeah. And these are not small side effects. And the other thing is the article kind of wanted to differentiate. It did mention the O pill when it said, but the O pill is progestin only. So the risks are different, which I will admit, I have also understood that to be the case as well. As a lactation consultant, we're like, if you're going to be on the pill when you're breastfeeding, you want it to be the mini pill, but you have to be really vigilant about the timing. You're more likely to make a mistake on the mini pill and get pregnant, but the risks are lower. And maybe like the absolute numbers are, but the way that these provider sheets broke down the risks is that it just put them in the common side effects were greater than or equal to. So at minimum, one in 100 women will experience this when they take the pill. And then the middle category was between one in 100 and one in 1,000. And then the low risk was less than one in 1,000. So that's how this broke them down. And the risks were almost all the same. Even the blood clot risks, like I said, at least in those columns, the absolute numbers might be different. But that was surprising to me because I always thought the combo pill was just more dangerous outright. I mean, that's what I took for 10 years, and I am very thankful that I did not have a blood clot while on it. But it talks about, again, the provider sheet talks about certain laboratory tests that should be ruled out before prescribing the pill. I don't know anyone whose doctor drew like lipid and lipoprotein fractions, a coagulation studies, a thyroid panel, a renal function panel. These are all on the provider insert saying that responsible prescription should require knowing your patient's risk factors in these categories. So that was interesting.
I mean,
Yes.
I have not met a person, and not that everybody I ever meet says it tells me their history with birth control.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, I don't know anybody who's had that experience with their provider. And that also makes me think about the way in which certain organizations like Planned Parenthood give out free birth control to people just walking in, on their first appointment. Then they're not getting that kind of comprehensive risk assessment either.
And then there's this rhetoric that like abortion care as health care or the birth control pill as health care, and it's not. So common side effects, chime in wherever you want. Common side effects of both pills, mini and combo, depression, emotional lability, decrease and loss of libido, headaches, migraines, nausea, abdominal pain, breast pain, unplanned uterine bleeding, increased weight. And these were all things that this article like dismissed outright. Women are claiming they gained weight. Women are claiming they had mental health changes. And I'm like, it took me about 5 minutes on the company's website to see that those are not just idle claims.
And you know, I went back even to before we spoke, I went back to some of my training because I thought that this was in in the history of the training that I did to become a perinatal mental health specialist. And I was right. Right, this was in there that a risk factor for later onset of a perinatal mood or anxiety disorder is beginning hormonal birth control. And so it is a documented risk factor that a person might begin to experience postpartum depression or anxiety once starting hormonal birth control after having a baby.
When starting it after
Yes.
or when coming off of it?
No, when starting it
Oh,
after.
very interesting. Okay, very interesting.
Yep.
Yeah, and I went on and off of it enough, unfortunately, that I always knew that the first month that I was on it, I was going to have a terrible migraine. And, and it's just like, why wasn't I asking questions about these things? And you consider the benefits and the risks, and we should all consider the benefits and the risks of everything, but I was not considering those. I was only just considering the benefits. But what was interesting was then the progestin only one. Some of the things that were different was that it was like, asthma was mentioned as one of the side effects, and breast pain, and like they were slightly different, but the blood clot risk was the same for both of them. And I just that was immediately where my head went when I read this article. I was like, these aren't idle claims. These are, first of all, real experiences that real people had, and second of all, they're in the literature. And I don't know why there's any argument that that's not a real thing. So, did anything, do you have any quotes from the article that stood out to you that you wanted to comment on? I'll link to it. And I mean, I hate to like give it more attention, but if somebody hasn't read it,
You know, actually, some of the comments, there was something I wanted to comment on in the comments is there were some people expressing that resistance to this sounds like a double negative, this article, any resistance to this article, so basically us, that this is a privileged view of birth control methods and family planning. I can see where it would initially sound that way. I really can. Because like you said, there are people who are not in a safe situation, for example. There are people who do not have as much access to the education that we do around this stuff. And so, in some ways, it is a privileged view. At the same time, I don't think that saying that this is the best option for people, something that potentially causes them harm or at least has higher risks than what they understand, I don't think that that is responsible either. And so, even if a person does not have as much access to education or is not in a safe situation, that doesn't mean ultimately we can't work to make bigger societal change in which this is common knowledge. Like understanding your menstrual cycle is common knowledge. Knowing when you're fertile and when you're not is common knowledge. The kind of knowledge that is passed down from mother to daughter, from grandmother to granddaughter, from aunt to niece, from friend to friend, you know, that's my hope and my view is that we can move in that direction so that this is not information that any person would lack access to because we all it can be just part of our normal daily living.
Yeah, and I think you and I are probably the first generation where birth control was so normalized that that was the baseline. Like a controlled 28-day cycle and light withdrawal bleeding is the norm. I mean, probably that should be the norm, but it's not in the world we live in when you're off the pill. But I think that because the sense of control is there, it makes what is actually real look wildly messy and chaotic and scary. And you're right, exactly right, that it takes that kind of ancestral knowledge and societal support to change the narrative on that again, to where, perhaps that's the norm. And you and I have talked about this. We don't have a ton of more time to t dig into this, but I'm not a feminist scholar at all. I could not tell you what wave of feminism we're on at this point, but I initially bought into what I would maybe call the feminist narrative of birth control, and that this gives us our life back. This allows us to compete in the workplace or what have you. And I think it's just wild, again, to take a step back and critically think about it. Is it, it's not Jolene Brighton, it's somebody else who talks about, now more people are talking about it, how men have like a 24-hour hormonal cycle, right? It's like the sun. And then women have like a 28-day hormonal cycle. So it's like the moon. And even though I'd been using natural family planning for 10 years, when I heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, yes. Like, why would we ever think that suppressing the natural cycle? Because you look at men, when men have low testosterone, it's not good. They don't function well, they don't feel good, they don't sleep well, they gain weight, they are depressed. So we don't suppress testosterone in men, and we don't suppress their natural cycle. And I don't understand why it's anti-feminist to say, why would we suppress the women's hormonal cycle in the same way?
For sure. I totally agree with that, and I think that in many ways, it's disempowering to disconnect women from their natural cycles, from the physiological hormonal change that happens from day one of your menstrual cycle all the way through. It informs us about things going on within our own bodies, like you talking about with endometriosis, for example. Symptoms, if you're able to experience those symptoms, as unpleasant as that is, you actually get to say, okay, this is a problem. How can we make this better? And on top of that, there is this whole school of thought and understanding about kind of the way that we experience the world in these different phases within our menstrual cycles and how that helps us to function in our lives. That there's this experience of, as you are like during your bleed, there's this experience of release and this need for rest. And then leading up to ovulation, this sort of energy and creativity, so there are all of these other components of actually experiencing a menstrual cycle that are of benefit to women and their lives and relationships that are completely missed out on when they're being suppressed.
Yeah, I was just joking with a friend, like, how many new business ideas do I have 3 days before ovulation? Or like, how much writing do I do in that 3-day window? And then I like abandon my manuscript for the rest of the month. And then I come back to it. Or once, even my husband recently was like, have you ever noticed? I was like slicing a jalapeno. He was like, have you ever noticed that you eat more spicy food at this time of your cycle? And I'm like, no, but I'm very impressed that you noticed that.
That is very impressive that he noticed that.
Then now I've been paying attention. I'm like, oh, I do at certain points crave spicier food. Who knows why? But this is a part of who we are as women. And As much as I've been at war with a lot of that in my own medical history, denying it and sweeping it under the rug doesn't actually solve any problems physically or emotionally, as you know, as a counselor.
Yeah.
So I think that there is a time and a place for things, but this article was alarming and warranted discussion.
Indeed. I mean, yeah, there is a firestorm of of information and resistance to this on social media right now. And I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it because I've basically just been seeing all this other stuff out there and wanting a chance to have a conversation. So I'm glad we did.
I'm really glad that we did. And I'll share my closing thought. And if you want to say anything else, one thing in this article I found really interesting towards the end, there's a bunch of quotes from various people basically reiterating the point of the article. But there's one comment where it says Jenny Wu, an OBGYN resident at Duke University, noticed that her Gen Z patients were turning away from IUDs at higher rates than her millennial patients and were referencing TikToks about the pain of IUD insertion, which is a very real problem. So this resident analyzed the 100 most popular TikTok videos about IUDs and found that most of them were negative. And she said, it changed how I practice. So this whole article is saying social media is horrible. Don't listen to it. And then at the end of the article, they quote this doctor who said, actually, there were enough people claiming that this experience was painful, traumatic, harmful, that now I use anti-inflammatories, lidocaine injection, or anti-anxiety medication before IUD insertion.
Oh my goodness.
So the article came back around to disprove itself, basically. It
Oh, unreal.
was not a very well-written article in the
Yeah.
first place, but that caught my eye at the end. And I'm like, that's responsible medicine. That's to, like, looking at the experiences and saying, how can we make this better? If this is how women are interpreting this experience, how can we improve it?
Yes. Good for her. And I'm glad it's there. And I hope more people see that who are reading it thinking, wow, what a great article. Which, I mean, I don't know how many people are reading it and saying, what a great article, but at
I
least
mean,
that they're getting to that point and going, well, there's something to be said about listening to women.
Yeah, maybe we should end there. Thanks for talking. Hopefully,
Yeah.
it's kind of probably a little more fired up than a lot of my, very well scheduled interviews, but it's just silly that we aren't using critical thinking in this day and age.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And
So,
I think it's good to have just a natural conversation about this stuff.
without an agenda. I don't care what anybody does, but I do want them to think about both sides of the question.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Milk and Motherhood today. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to some of the things we talked about. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends or leave a review to help other people find us here. As always, you can find me on Instagram at happy.mama.healthy.baby or on the internet at happymamahealthybaby.co. See you next time.